going on, Murph? How are your holidays? Everything good? New Year's, Christmas, all that good stuff?
Yeah, it's been almost a month, huh, Joe? It went fast, though. Yeah, it was.
We needed a lot of time to recover after that Winter Classic, which was, you know, a lot of work while it was going on and a pretty brutal performance.
Very anticlimactic. That's how I would describe that.
Yeah, so we will pretty much barely not talk about the Winter Classic at all in this episode. But we've got some good stuff. We've got Kevin Paul DuPont as a guest. We'll talk to him about just growing up around here and his inspirations becoming a Hall of Fame hockey writer and a lot of the Bruins issues out there, including the very polarizing Louis Erickson, who has his share of lovers and haters out there. You want to start the show, Murph?
Let's do it.
All right, let's start the Great American Hockey Show. Hit the music. Welcome back to the Great American Hockey Show podcast. Your host, Joe Haggerty, here with my partner in crime, James Murphy, from Bruins Daily. Murph, what do you make of the Louis Erickson situation? Obviously, Darren Dreger comes out, reports that the Bruins and Erickson's camp are talking. 5 or 6 year deal for $6 million plus per season for a 30-year-old player with concussion history. It smacks to me of paying for past performance for a player that's all of a sudden having a phenomenal year when his contract is up, and there are a lot of warning signs and danger bells there about doing something like that with Louis. What do you think?
I don't even think there's much of a, you know, a back and forth here in terms of what you do. I think you trade him no matter what. I mean, you have a great trade ship right now to get exactly what you need, and that is another defenseman. You need a number two or you know, 2/3 guy right now. Char is clearly on the decline. And we've discussed it before, and it's gotten worse since we last.
You're getting diminishing returns from a guy that's playing almost 25 minutes
exactly.
a night and is making
mistakes. Seidenberg is still kind of rusty, you know. And
I think
we don't know.
Just is what he is at this point.
He is what he is.
He's 34,
exactly.
35, and he's not
so
the same.
I don't understand the debate here, Joe. I think the debate should be who do we go after, not do we trade him or not. That's the Bruins right now have to be saying who do we target. What defensemen are we targeting out there? And there's plenty on the market this year, so you got to take that opportunity right now and run with it.
And we will get to the defensemen a little later on in the show that we're kind of thinking about it or looking at. But and I agree with you. You know, whether it's a rental for rental and you're getting a defenseman that's in the last year of his deal just like Louis Erickson, and it's sort of more of an equal hockey trade for a guy that can come in and stabilize things right now and help you down the stretch into the playoffs – or a guy that's got, you know, some more years or term on his contract.
I think that's what they'd want, obviously.
Obviously, but you'd have to give up a lot more than Louis Erickson to get that.
But they've got that.
Yeah, they do. But, you know, it's not going to be a Louis Erickson for, say, Kevin Shattenkirk. If that were to happen, it would be a Louis Erickson and, you know, a first-round pick probably and maybe something else to make something like that happen because Shattenkirk's got another year left on his deal.
And he's young.
Right. But as far as Louis Erickson goes – obviously, he gives good stat. You know, the advanced stats on him are excellent. He generates things offensively. He helps in a lot of different categories. You know, the real analytical stat geek, hardcore, Corsi pushing people out there are going to love Louis Erickson. Just look at the numbers and say, oh, this guy's great. You've got to give him whatever he wants. I just don't get the sense that the Bruins love him that much. Like, I think they value him if it were the right price, if it were, say, 4 years and, you know, $20 million or something like that. I think that they would be much more likely to bring in a player like that and to keep him and retain him. But once you start talking about, and he's going to go for top dollar, he wants to go to the market and get as much as he can. When you're talking about 5 years, $30 million, too much money for a player like that that's aging.
And they've got plenty of forward depth, too.
So, they do.
You know, keeping Louis Erickson isn't the difference between getting to the second round or just making the first round of the playoffs.
Well, I think that's the concern, right? And that's what people are afraid of with trading Louis is not only is he a good player in the future, and he probably will be for the next couple of years, and he does a lot of different things well, but it's more like are the Bruins giving up on this season and trying to make the playoffs if they remove such a big piece and a guy that's really helped carry them at the beginning part of the season? But, you know, they have wingers
so what
that
if
they can
are?
Bring in.
What if they are? I don't see that as a bad thing, Joe. We've discussed this before. Yeah, they want the money at the gate, but in terms of the future of this organization on the ice, you know, is it better to stay in the middle like that, or is it better to sort of rebuild, as we said before?
And as we said, maybe you get a defenseman that addresses a different need.
And now, you know, you and make the future.
It, yeah, but you address something this year and you continue to make the team better, even though you're making it worse
exactly.
in one area where you have depth. You're bringing in something that's more of a need, and, you know, that will help the team this year. But, you know, I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this right up until the end of the February trade deadline. And I do feel, as you do, that Louis Erickson is going to get moved. Probably not for futures, probably for something to help them immediately right now as far as a defenseman goes, and that's the right move. But moving on past Louis Erickson, let's move into our interview with Hall of Fame hockey writer Kevin Paul DuPont, and you know, start where some of the humble hockey beginnings started with old Dukes. And we're happy to have on the line, really needs no introduction, Boston Globe columnist, longtime hockey reporter. I think it's approaching 40 years you've been covering the sport, and 2002 Elmer Ferguson Memorial Award winner, which means he's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Kevin Paul DuPont, Dupes, how are we doing this morning?
You left out Twitter fiend.
Yes, yes. You block with impunity on Twitter, which I absolutely love.
It's great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. And with every guest, Dupes, we go back to the beginnings. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up? And sort of what was your connection to hockey as a kid, sort of growing up and in your formative years?
I feel like I'm being led down the primrose path on this, but I'll play along, guys. So I was, this is interesting. I was born in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1953. And my first, would have been late 50s on a very, I could take you to this place, a very small patch of ice in Bedford, Massachusetts, where we had moved when I was just a little kid. And a very small patch of ice on the very outskirts of what was then a Nike missile site. If you guys ever even heard of those. But this was during the Cold War and post-Korea, and the U.S. government had a number of Nike missile sites spread around the country, which is part and parcel, by the way, of when you're traveling down the Mass Pike now, the bridges had to be of a certain height in order for the missiles to be transported down the Mass
Pike. No kidding.
Yep. So there you go. Whenever you're driving out to UMass, you can keep that in mind. And if you hear incoming, duck to the side of the road.
So is that in an area like that? That's where you started skating, or is that
that's where I started skating and started, you know, just knocking around with a puck a little bit. Me and my dad. And my dad was a great skater. My dad was very ill as an adult with something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, where they told him he would never walk again, but he was able to get back. It was mistaken for polio when he was in his early 30s. I was just 5 or 6 years old. So he really gained back his leg strength from skating, which he had done. He grew up in Central Mass and was a great outdoor skater. So I skated quite a bit with him. We would go when I was... This is probably far more detailed than you guys want.
No, this is excellent. What you're talking about, it sounds like that's where kind of your pure love from the sport comes from, is maybe those moments as a kid growing up with
sure.
your dad.
Yeah, no question about that. So when we moved to Bedford, he and I were skating incessantly wherever you could go. And it wasn't that easy then, because this was pre-OR. There weren't that many indoor rinks, so we would go around to down to basically any little place that would freeze over to skate. There was a place in Arlington Heights, or right on the Lexington Arlington Heights border. I remember a public school there that flooded, and actually they would put a single swath of boards right down the middle of the ice surface. So on one side you'd have figure skaters, if you will, and one side hockey skaters. So we were always shooting up against those boards. And then my high school, so I went to Bedford High School. And there was I could take you to this spot, too, in Bedford, just off Page Field.
You know, we're going to need to do this at some point, Dupe. This is your life tour. I want to take this where we go to these different spots.
That's right. Yeah. So you'll have absolutely no listeners left. but there was a patch in Bedford that the high school hockey team practiced outdoors on. And it was the duty of the Bedford Fire Department in the late 50s and early 60s to keep daily maintenance of that outdoor surface. So the pumper trucks would come down, they'd pump out the water onto the surface, and they'd keep it. And it was only the sharpest kids who got up the very first thing, pre-dawn on Saturday morning, to make their way down to that surface and got the open use of it for about an hour. So those are great, great outdoor hockey memories for me.
How did that translate into becoming a reporter, getting into journalism, and sort of going in that direction? When did you decide that's what you wanted to be and that's what you wanted to do?
I didn't sort of look at that as what I wanted to do as I was growing older, and I was looking at professions, and I wanted to get into some sort of journalism. I can't say it was necessarily hockey. It was more baseball that drove me to that, because I also loved baseball. And so when I went to college to BU, I was originally a broadcast and film major. I don't even know if they have that major specifically anymore. Hoping that I would be on the 4, 5, or 7 news. There were only 3 stations at the time, and ergo only 3 jobs at the time. And when I got there and I started taking print journalism courses, this was very soon, through long discussions there, I decided to go to print journalism by my sophomore year. And frankly, by my sophomore year, I was working at the Globe as a copy boy. So the reasons I went to that were very much job security, which sounds like a joke today.
Yeah.
But print journalism was really the bedrock foundation of all journalism, and TV, again, this is pre-ESPN, TV was really seen as certainly intriguing, and I think in some ways more intriguing than it is today, simply because there were only 3 stations, and ergo three, if you will, varsity jobs. They all had weekend anchors and maybe another reporter assisting, but there were so few jobs if you wanted to stay here, and that was my wish. I hope to earn a living, stay in Boston, and really write baseball, and I did. I was a Red Sox beat man in my early 20s for what was then the Boston Herald American, and loved every minute of that, even though, as I've said for many decades since, I think covering baseball is a mental illness.
Yep, I agree. you can't have a normal life and cover baseball. You just can't do it.
No, you can't. You can't. And what happens is, again, this is one man's view of this. What happens is when you're in there and you're not having a normal life, your personal life becomes very distorted. You see it through a very, very mixed up prism. And I've got some friends who've stayed with it their whole lives. I've told them that before. I can't say any of them have ardently disagreed with my opinion. But it was actually an office coup in, I don't even know what year now, but I know Cherry was the coach. It was an office coup in the late 70s where the boss who had put me on daily Red Sox beat coverage wanted to bring back his pals onto the beat. And the next thing I knew, I was doing Bruins for the purely for the hope of the sports editor at the time that I would quit. But I didn't. I didn't. I loved it. I loved the people. Certainly loved the sport. As you might surmise, I loved the skating. And that's really how that happened. I think had it not been for the office coup, I probably would have continued with my mental illness.
Well, Dupes, I'm glad you were cured. I want to go back a few years back before you took that, before the office coup happened. Just tell us, as a journalist and a member of the media, what it was like when Orr basically took the city over and the state over and the region over.
It was a magical time here. So this would have obviously, Orr showed up in 66 and, the Bruins had had a great stretch of years through the 50s and into the 60s where they truly, I'm not going to say they were irrelevant because that's too easy in this town. I don't think they were ever irrelevant. You got to remember, too, the Red Sox were doing nothing. The Patriots were in their infancy and frankly got better pretty quickly. The only thing we had around here of any kind of boasting rights were the Celtics. And that was a very kind of interesting market in and of itself. Even when they were having their championship years, they weren't the greatest draw going. So it was a strange, dormant time, as it was for the city until the advent of bringing the city back at the very start of the 70s through Quincy Market and Faneuil Hall. This was a very dormant town in many ways, economically, certainly from a sports standpoint. But anyway, back to the question. Here was ore, and no one had ever seen, certainly no one in this city, and no one in the original six had anyone seen anyone like him because of the way he pushed the puck. And pretty soon, because of the trade for Esposito and bringing in Hodge, they had years ago brought in Busick from Detroit. It took on a feeling and a fervor here that really I have not seen matched. I know people are in love with the Patriots. I lived through the whole Red Sox thing, and frankly, at the time, I was more of a Red Sox fan than I was an NHL or Bruins fan. I know what that hysteria was in 67. I still have the album. I still have the scrapbooks.
Still have the Yaz bread?
The Yaz bread, I just gave that up. So all of that said, it was because he was such an uber talent and a humble kid, and then it was dressed up with the craziness of Derek Sanderson and how they scored and how they just clobbered people. And here's the ugly little sin that I carry around with me: how much I love the fights. Absolutely, the bloodier, the better. And I cheered it on like nobody's business. So, I still have fond memories of all of it, including the bloodbaths, Forbes Kennedy with Toronto in 69 and taking on everybody. And it was a wild, wild time. And I might add, it was also affordable.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Speaking of, it was
$2 to sit upstairs.
Wow.
Yeah, which is amazing to think about. I know, no kidding. It was the same way with the Celtics, right? I remember people telling me the Bill Russell Celtics, those era, how cheap the tickets were and how they're easily and readily available they were. You could just walk up and go into those games.
Unreal. Just
a totally different era. You mentioned the bloodbath, Stoops, and obviously there's been a big reversal of opinion in this modern age of hockey. How did that transformation of opinion come about for you, and that sort of different way of thinking of going from somebody that loved it at that point during the Orr era to now, you're one of the most vocal people against fighting and wanting it out of the game as much as possible.
Which is all right. That's an accurate depiction. The only slight variation I can give to that is when you've got two guys who really hate each other and they're mad, and the hate, of course, has all been diffused because there are so many teams now. Mm. Again, I grew up in an era of six teams, so you saw those four teams night after night, those five other teams night after night. Certainly it wasn't 82 games. I think it was 76, if I'm doing the math right. But it was very frequent that you saw the names and you saw these animosities fester. And the fights made sense. You knew these guys didn't like each other. Now, it goes to the 30-team league, because I've just advanced here by 50 years. But over the course of 50 years, those animosities and hatreds, they're just not in it. So, frankly, starting in, I would say, by the late 70s, pre-WHA, when the WHA came in and they took those franchises in for the start of 79, I think so many of these fights just became staged and cartoonish, and there were guys on the roster who couldn't play. That's all that they could do. It just became this aberration of what I saw as raw emotion through fighting. So, again, I'm growing older here too, right? So I'm talking about when I was loving it as a kid. I was 12 and 13. I hopefully we all evolve and we get to different places in our life. And looking at this stuff as an adult now, and really seeing it more theater than true sport, that was, take me through those 20 years of watching that. And then, of course, in these last 8 to 10 years where, and I may be exaggerating in terms of term, but let's go to 5 to 8, where science has caught up to this and people see that the damage done from repeated concussions, or not even concussions, subconcussive hits, people getting, you know, people taking on these CTE symptoms of dementia-like, in some cases, Gehrig-like disease. I think it certainly made me look at it differently. I think it's made a lot of people look at it differently. And that said, I went to UFC the other night. If it's a fight, it's a fight. You know, if it's two, if even in hockey, I'm okay. If it's two guys, that's what they do, then okay. Let them do it, I guess. I have less, I don't get as excited as I did, but okay. But when you've got guys going out, and this was the real turning point for me forever, watching Savard get brutalized by Matt Cook, to me, targeted headshots and actually going out to maim people, that's not sport. That's just assault.
I agree. I agree with you 100%. And I, you know, there's the classic argument that because the fighting is not a threat like it used to be, because of the instigator, because of the environment of the NHL right now. And I agree with you about the mounting scientific evidence, and it's getting harder and harder, certainly to justify the orchestrated fights and the, you know, the pro wrestling sort of thing that was going on for a while there, that nobody needs. But, you know, to have the inability of players to go after a guy like Matt Cook, it almost fosters more of an environment where you're going to see that kind of stuff happen. And, you know, that's the classic concern, I guess, from the instigator and from this continued legislation out of the sport, you know, and even to Sean Thornton getting whacked like he did a couple of years ago for jumping Brooks Orpik, who was, you know, turning himself into a human missile and going after Thornton's teammates. It almost brings about this environment where, you know, you're going to see more of that. It's that's a concern of mine just about the game and the sport in general.
And I would say that's a legitimate concern. And my only answer to that is what I've said all along about this. And so much of this is the macro picture of fighting is that's the responsibility of the paid officials, and frankly, very well paid officials.
Right.
They've got four of them on the ice. And again, I think this argument is virtually going away. You know, there's so little to talk about fighting anymore, and I'm thankful for that. That really the onus is on them, and as a league, if they can't get the right guys to do that job, then they've got to get the right guys to do that job. There's no other sport hack. You know, we don't talk about it with the NFL. We don't talk about it with NBA. You know, every sport could have this, but it doesn't. It hasn't been weaved into the culture, and when the stuff happens, it's mitigated right on the field, and that's what you have to hope for. In this sport, I don't think there's a parent alive who puts their kid into hockey at age and pick one, 6, 8, 10, thinking that, you know, I hope my kid can go out there and handle himself in a fight. That's not what any sport other than wrestling, martial arts, boxing is supposed to be about.
Dupes, you know, I heard former NHL Terry Ryan, he played for the Canadians. Obviously, his career didn't turn out as planned, and he kind of went in thinking he was going to be a scorer and ended up having to be a fighter just to survive. He's just saying his argument was, look, if you're going to take out fighting, then you got to take out hitting because there's way more injuries that are coming from hitting than there are from fighting. And, you know, I see both sides of the arguments. I see what you and Hags are saying right now. My thing is, though, I always go back to what Don Cherry says repeatedly, and nobody has – really, there's been no push with the NHLPA to do this, no push from the league, and I'm really surprised at it, is that they don't shrink the equipment a bit. I mean, these elbow pads and these shoulder pads are pure weapons. Would you not agree?
Sure, which not only fits into an argument or discussion about hitting and fighting, but it certainly is germane to another one of my favorite subjects. I promise not to hijack this podcast. is the whole lack of scoring?
Yes.
So, yeah, the equipment.
The goal scoring equipment crisis in the NHL.
Yeah.
Dupes.
Yeah, but you know, the equipment thing for me is just as salient. This discussion is just as salient in the NFL for all the equipment they're running around with.
Yeah.
You watch an NFL game and you try it. Not that this would ever happen, but watch the playoff game on Sunday with the Patriots in Denver and ask yourself, how different would this game be if there were no helmets? If they were, you know, actually give them everything they've got. Give them everything they've got, but send them out there without helmets.
Well, they wouldn't be aiming for Gronk's knees.
That's right. They wouldn't be aiming at Gronk's knees, and they wouldn't be. Well, they'd be, you know, it'd be an entirely different game. And I'm sure there's a very vociferous crowd out there that would say it wouldn't be anywhere near as good. I don't know about that. You know, first of all, we've never seen it. You don't know till you try, which is, you know, my classic argument with the NHL. You know, I can come up with this. You guys can too. 100 different things they could try. And people just shoot it down before, okay, yeah. Have we seen it? Have we seen them try it? You know, is there research and development to see what it might be? Maybe it's the greatest thing going. There may be a content. I wouldn't be one of them, but certainly I would listen to those right now who tell me that 3-on-3 is a great game. You know, there's a lot of excitement in it. I'll say that.
I will drop myself down into my sort of Cro-Magnon man way of thinking right now.
That boy.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm going to get in touch with the inner caveman. Because part of in what you were talking about, you know, officials sort of treating it like the other major sports and not letting some of this stuff devolve the way it does, I would almost take the flip side argument that the fighting is one of the things that really differentiates hockey from those other sports.
It does.
And
yep.
and sets it apart in a way. And, you know, as much as the scientific data is there and as much as you want to wipe out unnecessary fighting, staged fighting, all that stuff, there's a visceral element and a Roman Colosseum element of everybody stopping
Absolutely.
What they're doing and watching when guys drop the gloves and hammer away at each other. And my concern is that the continued legislation of this out of the sport is going to take that element out and really surgically remove something from hockey and the NHL that has been one of the selling points and one of the things that hardcore fans have loved for years and years. You know, that's a big concern of mine.
I agree with probably 90% of your statement. The only thing I will say this is I don't think there's that many hardcore people left in the building.
Yeah.
I think there's an element of that. Now, if two guys start fighting, do most of the people become fight fans? Yes, they do.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm not going to deny that. But that's true in the schoolyard, Joe. That's true if you're at Walmart and you know you see two customers grabbing for the same last copy of whatever.
I saw an awesome brawl at CVS Pharmacy the other day. It was fantastic.
So, you know, you see two guys, this is a classic. We've all seen this this time of year, you know, in the city when two people are going after the same parking spot.
or somebody removes the plastic chair parking spot holder.
Exactly.
God forbid.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean it's sport. That doesn't mean what – if that's going to be the case, and fine. You know, maybe this is the time for some – really time for someone to develop an NHL rival league and have it go back to the 60s where you can crack two-handers over the head. You know, we saw that with Teddy Green and Wayne Mackey. You know, maybe you could bring back, and this is what the XFL tried to do to a degree, you could come back with the XHL and have all of that back in it. And really, I mean, I'm not advocating for it, but from what America is today or North America is today, there very well may be a market for that. That's not the sport, though, and I'm not playing purist here. I'm just saying I think as a society we've evolved, and again, because of the science, I don't think you'll see there will be players who would go into it no matter what, because we see that with the NFL. People, you know, those players well know a good percentage of them are going to end up brain damaged. So it's there. I will say this, Joe and Murph. When I first started covering night to night to night, you know, this is back in the old league when they started games at the Garden at 7:40, and every game had a minimum of 60 to 80 penalty minutes, and they fought all night, and you didn't even leave the press box till 10:45 most nights. Okay, so that was to go down to the room to talk to people, and here's you could almost count on every story talking about these key elements: the great fight, the great goal, and the great save. Okay, I go night after night. And and last night, guys, was the showcase piece. I don't know when this is airing, but Vancouver Bruins. Absolutely a no-hitter, snore job of a game.
Totally.
That was worse than the Winter Classic. At least the Winter Classic, you had the outdoor element.
Yeah.
People were excited for that. You know, it's unique. That game, Thursday night, Vancouver Bruins, was the showcase piece of, well, there's no fight, and that doesn't exist. I didn't see a good goal in it. Saves? Not really. You know, those were the elements of an exciting night. You got in the subway and you left the old Boston Garden, you talked about the great fight, the unbelievable goal, and how about, you know, Cheevers, you know, coming out to stop the angle or diving back to make the save.
Yep.
Yeah.
In this era, we have no fighting. The goal goes in, the puck goes in the net almost by accident on every goal.
Yeah.
Night after night on the ninth floor, I turned to Fluto or somebody next to me and said, how'd that go in?
that was actual a discussion I had with somebody last night after that game was over is, you know, in older days, couple of fights would liven that game up a little bit because that was a dreadful nothing game with absolutely nothing going on. And if you're a ticket payer and spent big bucks to watch the Canucks and the Bruins thinking that was going to be a great game, the rivalry between those two teams is clearly gone, and there was nothing interesting going on either side, yeah, which segues into, you know, as we sort of wrap this up eventually, what are your thoughts, Dupes, at this point, halfway through the season, this Bruins team, how do you evaluate them and sort of where they're at and where they're going? It's a difficult task for me because clearly they look like they're good enough to make the playoffs right now. But they also
they also
look like they're very far away from actually doing damage in the playoffs or going places anywhere significant. And it's a tough spot that they're in right now.
Yeah, which is to say it's pretty much where we left off with them at the end of last year, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, did they substantively change? They certainly did in terms of bodies in, bodies out. I can't say that the talent level overall changed much from last year. Obviously, the greatest delta in their play, by my eye, has been how good they have been on the power play. I'm not going to say that's the only surprise because it is a significant surprise, especially, you know, we've watched them really struggle on the power play here for years. So that's been a pleasant surprise. It hasn't been a surprise to me that they're going to play their best game when Seidenberg is healthy, when McQuaid is in there. And I think, again, Boston fandom really, really underestimated how good he is. Not to say he's a great player, but he's good. He's important to this core of six defensemen. And obviously you've got to have Krejci in there. So when they've got all their parts and their parts are playing anywhere from B or better, they're certainly they're a playoff contender. Are they going to chase for the cup? I don't think so. I don't think they have that sort of, they have less moxie than they used to have in terms of that sort of feisty, hard 5-on-5 play. They've made up for some of that loss of feistiness there with the ability to score on the power play, and that's significant. I think the goaltender is really good, and they play the, if you will, the you know, boring 5-on. They play the boring night-to-night game as well as the best of them. But when it comes to really, you know, ratcheting it up come playoff time, I don't see that they're going to have that gear. I don't.
No,
they're mediocre.
Yeah,
that's
and I don't even think a couple of big moves or whatever they can do at the trade deadline is not going to fix that either. You know, it might make them marginally better, but I don't think it's going to make them, you know, a threat to win three rounds and get all the way to the cup. That's for sure.
No, and again, some of that is just the way they are founded. In that, you know, I've said this for a number of years. If they could, you know, of course, there are no 50 goal scorers anymore, but let's say they could go out and add a dynamic goal scorer. Well, their system really doesn't reward the dynamic goal scorer. They've had dynamic goal scorers. They had Kessel. they had Sagan. It gets muted in this. Again, they have their way. Obviously, they can be successful. They won the cup 5 years ago, but that's not how they win. Their method is sort of adding pennies and nickels. They're not looking for 25-cent and 50-cent piece players. So when you talk about those dramatic pieces at the trade deadline, it's almost a moot point with this team. You know, they've got to set their line, like most teams do, set their lineup in July and hope that it plays out. And thus far, it's played out okay, but it has not made a quantum leap.
No doubt, Dupes. And next time we have you on, I promise we're going to get into why players like Kessel and Sagan and Dougie Hamilton, you know, don't seem to work out with this particular set of Boston Bruins. And I also want to talk to you a little bit at some point about what it was like covering Don Cherry your first year there, his last year in Boston,
sure.
Because I'm sure the experiences were pretty unbelievable. But we thank you very much for this time, and welcome to the Great American Hockey Show podcast.
My pleasure, guys. Carry on. You do great work.
You know, Murph, we were talking a little earlier in the show about Louis Erickson and, you know, whether they should trade him or not. And, you know, I think we're definitely both on the same page as far as dealing him prior to the deadline and that being the right move, particularly if the contract demands are what they have been reported to be, pretty extravagant. The question is now, available defensemen out there. You know, we mentioned Kevin Shattenkirk a little bit earlier. I think that's kind of a pie-in-the-sky ideal target. If they could get exactly what they wanted as far as a veteran player, I think that would be it. Clearly, a Seth Jones type would have been exactly what they want, which is a young player that they can build on for a long time, a potential heir apparent to Zdeno Chara, a top-pairing guy, and a guy they could control financially for a while. But that's going to cost a ton, and maybe they don't even have the resources to get something like that done unless they want to trade like a David Pastrnak, which I don't think that they want to do. So the question becomes, what other defensemen are out there besides Shattenkirk, who's an all-star, a puck mover, a young guy, a guy they tried to trade for when he was a member of the Colorado Avalanche,
yep,
before he got traded to the St. Louis Blues, a former BU player. So any other names out there that you're thinking might be possible as far as defensemen go before the trade?
Well, I think the one that's going to come up the most, Joe, is obviously Dustin Byfuglien in,
sure,
Winnipeg. I mean, and, you know, we've heard him linked to the Bruins. We've heard him linked to probably every single team in the NHL. This is a guy that it appears more and more that is not going to be re-signing in Winnipeg. They've just got too much on their plate to do it. They're dealing with Andrew Ladd, so he's going to be out there. I think, you know, if you packaged an Erickson, a top prospect, and a first-rounder, you could get him. Now, the question is, you're going for a rental there. Do you want to give that much up for a rental?
Well, I don't – yeah,
do you get the feel, though, that you could keep him? That's going to be the big deal there. But if I'm looking at Winnipeg, Joe, just quickly,
yeah,
I go for Trouba. That's the guy I like better because he's got the term, he's younger, he's cheaper, and he fits more into what I think the Bruins are doing going forward in the future.
Well, it's who I'm talking about, like with the young defensemen that they're targeting on these teams that they think they can, you know, kind of build around.
I don't think Byfuglien fits in.
No, he doesn't. And you're definitely not going to give up a first-round pick and Louis for a rental player. I mean,
right.
That's more of a rental.
That's what they'd probably want.
Right. More of a rental deal. And if you get a player like Byfuglien, if you're the Bruins, I feel like it's more of a, this is the best that we could get, rather than this is exactly who we wanted, you know. And it's more trying to fit whatever you can in there. Because, look, Byfuglien is big. He's strong. He's good offensively. Clearly, he'd fit right into what they're doing power play-wise. But does he really help them defensively at all? Does he really address a lot of what they need and,
no,
and what they're looking for?
He would give Claude Julien heart attacks.
He would. And he'd be a horrible match with Zdeno Chara. I couldn't see the two of them coexisting on a pairing together. I couldn't see that at all. A guy I would look at and I think is interesting, and a lot of people have talked to Cam Fowler in Anaheim, but I think Sami Vatanen is the one that I'd be looking at if I were the Bruins, and I think that's the one they're more interested in.
And I think that's the one that Anaheim's more willing to deal, too.
And he's not the biggest guy in the world, but he can move the puck. He's put up numbers already. I think he's still a player on the rise that you're going to be able to get at a reasonable rate. You're not going to have to super overpay when it comes to contract time for him. It's just a question of price and what you're going to have to pay for Anaheim. But at least you're dealing with the Ducks, a team that wants to move players and wants to move parts, and a willing
and
partner that can bring something in. Yeah, and could use a Louis Erickson type.
And, you know, of course, I'm going to just, you know, start it here as it always does every year. We'll start the Yandle to Boston rumors. He's there if you want him. And that's a guy, I mean, you know, I like Keith Yandle. I don't know if he's going to be worth what he might get on the open market, too. He's an impending UFA, so, but he's a guy to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, I'm just not sure. I see the Rangers dealing with the Bruins when both of them could be in the playoffs.
Right.
That would be a I agree. That's interesting. And certainly he might even look here in the offseason as a free agent. I think that would be something he and his agent would seriously look at. But I don't know if I see the Rangers and the Bruins making deals when they're going down the stretch and could potentially be crashing into each other come playoff time. But clearly the Rangers, the Bruins, there are a lot of teams out there like that that are contending for the playoffs and potentially looking at dealing off UFAs and rental players like that at the same time. It's an interesting dynamic there where they've got one foot in and one foot out.
Quickly, Joe, I just want to say, too, I want to get your take on it first. You know, I've heard people saying that the Bruins should go after Jonathan Drouin. I stay far away from this kid. I despise what he and his agent did. An entry-level player, he should honor his contract. He walks out on his team like that, I think, is a huge red flag. And I don't think really the Bruins need him right now. They've got enough forwards. I think they need to focus on defense. But what's your take?
Well, what has he done at the NHL level? I'm not even sold on that he's a bona fide superstar at the NHL, despite
it could be a bust
said. And I'm always wary of guys like him who are playmaking wingers, who are, you know, supposed to be a center, but they're really working on the wing and, you know, setting everybody else up. They're not really a goal scorer. Like, what does he do? I just think there's too many red flags with him, and I'm just not even sold that he's worth it as a player, all the rest of that baggage. But, you know, they will be looking for a winger, I think, at the deadline. Maybe try to find that right wing to go
but with not him.
Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand, because Brett Connolly, let's face it, hasn't been doing it, and he's been there for a couple months and hasn't been scoring goals. So they need to find somebody that can produce in that spot. Yeah, but it's not going to be Drouin. I think as far as that goes, they're going to look with somebody with a little more moral fiber.
He is this generation's Eric Lindros.
Next up is our three-period segment with Matt Bolesky, who talked about a bunch of different stuff with him. One of them was how much he loves Sons of Anarchy as a TV show, and he actually didn't tell me until after the recorder went off that Kim Coates, the guy that plays Tig on the show, took him on a tour of the set, and the guy that was the coach in Goon and all that, and they had a great time together. So I'll add that to what Matt Bolesky said in these three periods.
What is your favorite sports movie of all time?
Oh, favorite sports movie. There's a lot. I love Slapshot, obviously. All the great lines in there. Happy Gilmore being a big golf movie, that's up there for sure. It's probably one of my favorites.
And that's got the hockey element too, right, where he's a frustrated hockey player.
Yeah, he's got Bruins hats, Bruins jerseys. He's kind of plays right in.
Any particular song that you've always sort of listened to or that's gotten you kind of excited to play that you kind of go back to all the time?
That's tough. There's not one particular song that I go to all the time, but obviously some AC/DC, something like that brings you back from when you're, you know, kind of playing as a kid, and that stuff gets you going.
As far as your DVR TV shows, what do you have, like, the season recording on, you know, that you go back and watch?
Right now we're watching what everyone else is watching, how they're making a murderer, whatever it's called. We just started that. Sons of Anarchy was huge. That was a good one. I watched that whole thing. Ray Donovan, waiting for that to get going again. So we got a few. I'm kind of in between shows right now.
Wrapping things up here, Murph, we're going to go to a new thing, answer some Twitter questions from the Twitter followers out there. Dave Peasley asks, why are the Bruins having so much trouble winning at home?
I don't have an answer for that, Joe. I mean, I guess that the one thing I would say is that when you're on the road, especially with a team that's got a lot of youth on it, it's easier to stay within the structure of your game plan and kind of really tighten up as a group. And that's really my only explanation. I don't know what else it is. Personally, I don't like TD Garden, so maybe they're like me. It's not a great place to play.
That's true.
You know,
it's a very characterless building.
Yeah, it doesn't have much character.
No.
Artificial noise.
I don't even think it's any of that. I just think it's an immature team. For my money, I think they're focused a lot more on the road. I think they respect their opponents a lot more on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've seen many instances already this season of them thinking they're going to win the game right out of the gate and not really having to expend much energy or do much to beat a team. Like the Vancouver Canucks game is a perfect example. I thought they were just going to roll over the Canucks, and they weren't even, you know, working, trying to get to the net, doing anything. And
apparently they did too.
It backfired on them, you know, because they're just not a good enough team to treat teams that way, and they'd certainly do it more on home ice than away. And, you know, it's a sign of a team that needs to grow up a little bit and mature in some areas, certainly maybe some elements of the team. All right, Ray Garino, should the Bruins trade picks prospect or target picks prospects or an NHL player in a trade for Erickson?
Well, I think we've said this. They need an NHL player.
Yeah, I think and a defenseman. This is the carrot that you can dangle out there to get the defenseman that's going to eventually solve that problem for a team that's got a fatal flaw right now. They need another top three defenseman, and until that happens, you're playing Kevin Miller 20-plus minutes a night. Zdeno Chara is getting played way too much. Dennis Seidenberg is getting played way too much. That will help all of that area, and you know it's the one big piece of collateral they have before the trade deadline.
Yep.
All right, that's it for this week's Great American Hockey Show. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for Kevin Paul DuPont for coming on with us. Murph, as always, thanks for being in the co-pilot seat.
A pleasure.
All right, and as always, keep it great, keep it American, and always keep it about hockey. If you want to hear more Comcast SportsNet podcasts or learn how to subscribe to our iTunes feed, head over to csnne.com/podcast.